From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, our connection is made across the country in communities that have been roiled with tension. Police community relations strained in places like Ferguson, Cleveland, New York, and Staten Island, all the way down to North Charleston, South Carolina, with the case of Walter Scott and a police officer charged with murder. That is not to say that police officers aren't doing outstanding and important work every day in this country. Certainly they are. But that is to say that when you look around the country, you can start to ask yourself questions on why do some black people, especially in urban areas, why do they say they're scared of police officers? Why are police community relations strained at times? This hour, our guest is in from the University of Kansas, speaking to us after he spoke to students at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. David Roediger is what they call one of the most important professors and historians in this field. His first book in the early 1990s was The Wages of Whiteness, and that helped reframe the discussion and understanding about white advantage, as he calls it. And that's an important term. Later this hour, we're going to talk about the difference between white privilege and white advantage. But he helped set that historical narrative looking back at American history. His newest book takes us all the way back to the Civil War, leading up to the Emancipation Proclamation, and the role that slaves and freedmen had in pushing Abraham Lincoln to make some of those decisions. But let's talk to David Roediger first about some of the events happening around our country right now, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to Connections. Welcome to Rochester, and certainly hope that you've enjoyed your visit. I know the folks at Hobart and William Smith have appreciated your time. How has it been for you?
It's been great, and I hope to do some sightseeing today.
Well, very good. And, you know, I want to start with this. I was speaking recently to a high school English teacher, and I won't say where. It was a suburban district here in Rochester, highly regarded, highly rated, highly white as a district. And the English teacher told me that she has to convince her high school seniors that racism is still real. And she said half the class rolls their eyes and says, no way. We have a black president. This is a suburban district, a wealthy one, a smart one, well-regarded. But what does that say here in 2015 that a teacher has to explain to students racism is still real?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that racism's come to mean terrible personal habits of prejudice, and it attaches to people, not to systems. So as long as very few people are directly saying racist things, it's hard for young people to imagine that there's much racism, because that's what they've been told, is that racism is this bad personal behavior. So in Ferguson, for example, the recent Department of Justice report, the newsworthy aspect of that report for most media was that they caught cops emailing each other racist messages. And that proved the racism of Ferguson. And that's the same narrative, that as long as it's only about the personal words and hurtful saying of things, but the actual racism of Ferguson, the pattern of picking up black young people on frivolous offenses, racial profiling, that's not really portrayed as racism. So I'm a little bit sympathetic with the kids. I think that the kids are given this view of what racism is, and they're not hearing much racist talk. So they end up thinking, oh, well, how could you now be talking about racism?
And do we start to counter that by teaching racism not simply as words, but as systems?
Yeah. I mean, I always emphasize that the ism in racism is there because it means systematic. And if we start there and we try to figure out maybe if whether those police in Ferguson were actually engaging in those emails because every day on the job they were victimizing people. Maybe the bad talk comes from the bad practice and the bad system that they're caught up in enforcing. So I think we have to start with structure, and then we can, it's not to ignore personal racism and not to be appalled by things like the University of Oklahoma fraternity incident recently. It's not to put those to the side, but they're not the origin of the problem.
And so when we look at Ferguson, for example, how interesting that if those emails hadn't come out, there would be less attention on the actual system. Even though, at the, you know, the Washington Post and a number of other media outlets had reported on just the statistics, the raw numbers of stops. We've seen Jamelle Bouie in Slate writing about what he calls broken taillight policing,
right.
The notion of stopping, even if there are no legal grounds to make a stop on, as you say, frivolous offenses that lead to investigatory searches that unfairly target black people. But in terms of the actual systems, how do you start to affect change with it, David?
Well, my son actually is the attorney in the anti-municipal court lawsuits in Ferguson. And those lawsuits all predate Mike Brown's killing. People have known this as a problem for a long time. And most places don't have municipal courts of this. It's certainly most suburbs of 400 people don't have their own municipal court. The little towns around Ferguson, there are 20 of them that kind of run people back and forth from one court to another for minor traffic violations. So his stance and the lawsuit stance is that you need to actually just get rid of municipal courts in this instance. That's not the most important issue facing the United States, but it's a very important issue in Ferguson. And it's symptomatic of, I think, how out of the box we have to think in order to get at some of these problems. That problem is not really susceptible to being reformed very much, because when the police go to stop somebody, it's a perfect case of racial profiling, because they always find something. They don't find drugs, they don't find guns, but they find warrants. They find that this person has outstanding warrants. So the behavior just gets reinforced over and over again that, oh yeah, this was a successful stop because it turned out this person had two warrants for jaywalking from a year ago. So it really is a systematic thing that can't be kind of reformed around the edges.
Same thing with Walter Scott in North Charleston. It's exactly right. It was a broken taillight. His family said was frightened that he would go to jail for a totally unrelated issue to anything in his vehicle. But, you know, David, I've heard people say, well, Walter Scott should not have run. Walter Scott should have been current on his payments. That's all on him. And how do we respond to that?
There's a great new film called Ferguson Report from Occupied Territory that actually enters working class black people's lives in Ferguson and around in North St. Louis. And it just sort of shows how impossible those demands are, what a $500 outstanding fine means in the actual daily lives of people who often then, by having to go to court, lose what employment that they have, who lose the right to drive and are driving sometimes without standing warrants because they have to get to work or get their kids somewhere. I highly recommend this film because it's a chance to hear working African Americans talk about what this is in real life. Because I hear this on talk radio all the time in the Midwest. People say, well, when I get a parking ticket, I just pay it. And some of the things never happen to whites. Jaywalking, for example, 95% of the violations in North St. Louis and in Ferguson go to African American young people in areas that don't have crosswalks and don't have sidewalks. So where to walk is to jaywalk in a lot of instances. And so then that's what Mike Brown got stopped for, was supposedly jaywalking on this little lane. So I think that we need to kind of keep all of these things straight to say some of these things are violations really only for black young people. And that puts them in the system, and it means that the next time they get stopped, it looks like, oh yeah, here's somebody who's a recidivist and ought to get the full brunt of the law.
When it comes to racist systems, we had a lot of conversations in the last year on this program about 50 years since the Rochester. They're known as the race riots or the mm-hmm. demonstrations. 1964, we saw it. A weekend's worth of activity. Several people died, and what led to that, as described in a gripping film by Chris Christopher and Carvin Eisen, was a lot of black families moving to Rochester from the South throughout the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Kodak was doing well. There were jobs, and the idea was, well, this is a chance to get away from racist systems, and to come to a community that felt open, that was successful, where there was work. What they would find is, number one, there was often not hiring of minorities, and then number two, as you well know, mortgages were stacked against Black families. You know, you either couldn't get a mortgage, or the cost of a mortgage was double. And if you missed a payment, all of a sudden you had no equity, which is, of course, should be illegal. But that's exactly. And then what happens? Well, you lose your home and you get pushed into neighborhoods. You concentrate poverty. That's a racist system that built up into the 1964 race riots in Rochester. I'm wondering if most of the systems that we could look around and see that are racist, are they overt and cognizant? Do we have sort of racism within us that leads to some of these systems? And I know it's sort of a complex question, but what do you think?
Yeah. I don't think racism very often speaks its name. I think the great achievement of the Black Freedom Movement was to capture the moral high ground in the United States so that we don't hear racist talk. And when we hear racist talk, usually there's some kind of consequence. The fraternity is closed. The politician is discredited, at least for a little while. So I don't think we hear that kind of rhetoric. But what we do is inherit all of these past inequalities and in a lot of times reproduce them in the present as well. So you mentioned housing and the shutting out from FHA loans and the redlining of neighborhoods, the Jim Crow kind of system of housing. Well, Tom Shapiro at Brandeis has a center that studies inequality, and he finds that much of the wealth gap between whites and Blacks in the United States is exactly about wealth and housing. And somewhere along the line, many whites inherited or bought a house that has gone up in value and gone up in value. And it doesn't mean they're wealthy, but it does mean that they're a lot wealthier than the average African American. In 2008, I did a book called How Race Survived U.S. History. And when I wrote the book, I had a little post-it note on the computer that said white wealth is 8 times greater than Black wealth, 7 or 8 times. Now it's 14 times greater. And that increase is largely because so many African Americans and Latinos got caught in the subprime crisis. So a lot of the wealth differentials actually have to do with past advantages that get reproduced and current desperation around the question of housing.
I'm curious to know if you read Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay last year, The Case for Reparations. What was so interesting about that essay for The Atlantic was, so often when we hear the term reparations, people immediately assume it's for a payment to make up for slavery. And Ta-Nehisi Coates was saying, this isn't about slavery.
Right.
This is about the economic systems that have advantaged or disadvantaged Blacks for primarily and advantaged whites. And, I think after the essay, he still didn't create a formula for reparations. I don't think that was the point.
Right.
But the point was to make us think about beyond slavery, the issues. Is there a case for reparations on those grounds?
I think, first of all, that the word reparations is interesting because it now has a connotation that it's kind of an impossible demand and not a good thing, at least in the political mainstream. And it means repair. It's sort of the same thing that happened with the word welfare. The word welfare means something very good and noble. It means healthiness. And the word repair means something that we ought to all want. But in the rhetoric of it, we get to discredit those words. And once they get associated with the thriving of African Americans, the words themselves get discredited. I think that there's a case for reparation. The question is the formula. And, one of the things that we could think about is whether rebuilding inner cities and now inner suburbs where African Americans live is a strategy of reparation, whether having state-of-the-art computers, sort of like in that high school that you talked about to begin the segment, whether having those in city schools is a form of reparation, and whether having great public libraries is a form of reparation. And once you say that, you realize that to repair African American conditions is also to benefit all urban dwellers. I mean, I'm not against the idea that some kind of a check should be cut to African-American individuals. I'm not against that, but I don't think it's the most important form of reparation. I think reparation would, in the course of things, be a social process where cities are being rebuilt.
When we talk about reparation, inevitably people, not everyone, a segment of the population recoils. They say, that was generations ago. It's not me. It's not fair to me. The world's moved on. Don't keep us in the past.
Right.
Is that an indication exactly on that point that people are thinking of racism based on what they hear or don't hear on a day-to-day basis as opposed to thinking about systems?
I think it is, and I think Coates' essay is important in that regard in that it says, no, we're talking about things that keep getting reproduced. I grew up in southern Illinois in a town, very common town form in the Midwest, what people call a sundown town. And what that means is that, at least according to police practice and folklore, if not law, African Americans had to be out of town by sundown in the town that I mostly grew up in. That town was built around a big quarry, and those were good working class jobs. They all went to whites because African Americans couldn't stay in the town. When I go back and visit that town now, it still is maybe 1% African American. It still has very good working class jobs. So these are patterns that people say, oh yeah, that was a long time ago, but they persist right down into the present.
We're talking to David Roediger, who is Foundation Professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas, visiting Rochester and a guest at Hobart and William Smith College. Last week, he delivered a lecture and had some classroom visits, talked to students. And he's also the author of a number of books, probably most prominently The Wages of Whiteness, Race and the Making of the American Working Class, going back almost 25 years now.
That's right.
And for our audience who haven't read the book, set what that book was about then and how much or how much has not changed.
Well, the book is actually about the the 19th century in the United States. So it's a historical book, but it was trying to figure out when I began to write it in the 1980s, where the so-called Reagan Democrat, these white working class people who had always voted for Democrats, but then crossed over to vote for Ronald Reagan, where they came from. So The Wages of Whiteness is a historical book on when the term white worker came into the parlance of the United States and what it meant for people to identify more as white than as worker. And so it was meant to answer a contemporary question, which I think is still a contemporary question. We have a lot of people who are victimized by the economic system in the United States who are white, who vote in some ways for their own victimization for reasons that have to do with what Ian Haney Lopez has recently called dog whistle politics, issues of race that can be mobilized to shape divisions among working people and to elect conservative candidates in many instances. So I think it's about a problem that we very much live with.
When you now look at systems in this country, we've talked a bit about housing. A big issue in Rochester recently has been not just poverty, but concentration of poverty.
Yeah.
And the local community foundation has put together a number of studies in the last 2 years looking at how Rochester compares to cities of comparable sizes. Rochester, in almost 20 cities, roughly the same size, not only has the most poverty, has the most concentrated poverty, has the most severe poverty, which is the population living at 50% or less of the poverty line,
right,
and more than 50% of children in Rochester living in poverty. And the man who wrote the report on this program, you know, he was responding to some comments from listeners who say, well, you know, you can't necessarily just snap your fingers and fix it, because if white people are successful, or if people are successful and they want to live in the suburbs, they don't want to be near a concentration of poverty, they have every right to do that, and you can't tell people where to live. He responded, oh, we can tell people where to live, and we do. We concentrate the poverty because of poor housing policy. And yet I talk to suburban mayors, suburban supervisors. I don't know how you change a concentration of poverty. I don't know what policies will start to fix that, David. What do you think?
Yes. Well, I think it's a really important issue. I think that people sometimes say the sheer numbers of white poor people are as great as the numbers of African-American poor people and sort of draw an equivalency there. And it's an important thing to say that and to realize that there are lots of white poor people. But white poverty tends to be lived out in areas that have access to resources in ways that segregated areas of concentrated poverty don't have access to resources. So there's much more in and out of white poverty than there is in and out of black poverty in areas of concentration in what used to be called ghettos, but now are actually often inner suburbs in the bigger cities in the United States. So sprawl really contributes to this. You get this very far out suburbs, which create yet another area in which there are some white poor people, some rural poverty that's still going on around those suburbs. But there's no movement for addressing the problem of poverty that's not associated with race. There just can't be a movement to address this without taking race into account.
I wonder if it just feels too far out of reach here. We've had poverty initiatives, poverty teams, anti-poverty coalitions. There's a brand new one being headed by a number of state leaders in Rochester. And I think it's absolutely well-intended.
Yes.
Absolutely well-intended. Have you seen anything around the country that's worked?
I think that there are initiatives. I know you're from Cleveland. My friend John Powell, who works on sprawl and concentrated poverty, teaches at University of California's Law School in Berkeley, had some successful programs when he was at Ohio State that he was associated with that worked in Cleveland in small ways. But part of what has to be done is to rebuild those areas of concentrated poverty. I don't think it necessarily means to shuttle people around as a strategy. I mean, there's building successful black communities is also still an important public policy goal, I think.
And we're also having that same debate that a lot of communities are having about quality of schools, which is certainly related to what poverty is at the core of that debate. Some want to argue that if you fix the schools, you'll fix poverty. Others say that it's getting the chicken and the egg exactly backwards, and that sure, schools could always be improved, but for the most part, if you have highly concentrated poverty, it doesn't matter what reforms you bring into schools.
Yeah.
What do you make of that debate?
Well, I think part of the form of that debate is the idea that charter schools can be a solution for all of this. And I come from the reason I was able to go to college is that my mom was a grade school teacher without a full college education. And so I come from a very strong belief in public schools. But I also think that it's important to acknowledge that those public schools have failed city kids, African-American kids, to a very considerable extent. So there's going to be organically this push for charter schools in a lot of areas. And I think it's important for teachers unions, for example, to say we want good public schools, but to say it in a way that doesn't pretend that we already have good public schools. We have to build those schools. And I don't think that charter schools make much of a contribution to the building of those schools, but in some places they have at certain moments.
Let's get a very short break in, and in our next half hour, we're going to talk about the definition of white privilege. Is it used too often? Is it used incorrectly? What term does David Roediger prefer and why? That and much more with the historian and author and professor who's in studio with us this hour on Connections. Talking to David Roediger, the author of a number of books, and not the least of which, The Wages of Whiteness, Race and the Making of the American Working Class. His newest book is Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. He's been in Rochester in the Finger Lakes talking to students at Hobart and William Smith College and talking about various issues related to the historical implications of what we've seen in the last year. And I've seen more conversations about privilege than, yes, in the last year than I've seen. So before I even get into some of what the debate about privilege is, when students raise their hand and say, Professor Roediger, how do you define white privilege? How do you answer that question?
Well, I'm a little bit of an agnostic on the term. I sometimes wish that we had said through the years, white advantage. White privilege sounds too grand, I think, in certain ways. And there is a legitimate response that says, well, wait a minute, I'm poor. Wait a minute. Think about Rochester and the loss of tens of thousands of good jobs. I got caught up in that. My house is worth half as much as it used to be worth. So I think when you are talking to people who have experienced those things and they say, I don't feel like I'm privileged, I feel like I'm barely making it, that it's important to be able to say exactly what's at issue. And maybe advantage describes that a little bit better. So not getting picked up on a racially profiled traffic stop, not being incarcerated at seven or eight times the rate of the white population for, in many cases, exactly the same patterns of drug use that cross the color line. Is it a privilege to not be a victim of police abuse, or is it kind of a right? Is it just an advantage? So I understand the argument about why privilege is not necessarily the best word. And I think we ought to have that argument, because I sometimes think that white privilege is too easily invoked by relatively prosperous liberals in society as if it's some kind of a magic wand to address problems. And it actually is only such a magic wand if you can construct a political coalition that moves in a progressive direction around the term. I think we could probably construct broader coalitions around the term white advantage than white privilege.
Well, writing on exactly that theme in the New Republic, Phoebe Maltz Bovey writes a piece called We're Checking the Wrong Privilege, and I'll read from part of that and we'll talk a little bit more about that. She writes, quote, while there's a correlation between first gen and low income, the biggest problems, students' inability to afford textbooks and extracurricular activities in classroom settings, for instance, would also apply to any low-income students whose parents had gone to college. The challenges are primarily financial, not cultural. So why, then, are we reading about which students had access to, quote, daily doses of NPR? Does repeated exposure to Terry Gross cover tuition and living expenses? This is only the latest example of a long-running campus conversation about the subtle cultural ways in which class asserts, a conversation that all too often ignores the realities of economic inequality. Privilege workshops and introspections abound in higher education, yet there's scant evidence that increased awareness will reduce the underlying financial obstacles.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, and the kind of keeping class in the forefront and economics in the forefront is an extraordinarily important point for our moment. But at the same time, we're seeing all these police killings that are racial killings to a very large extent. So there's no reason, really, that we can't keep two things in mind at once. We know that people don't live as a racial identity in one moment and a class identity in the next moment, or live in only one or the other. People live in both of these identities and in gender identities at the same time. So we ought to be able to think that there are problems that are class-based and that those problems are lived out in different, as Stuart Hall used to say, different modalities for Black people and white people, that the experience of it is different. I was in South Africa right when the ANC took power. I was teaching at the University of Western Cape, and old-timers in the liberation movement in South Africa used to articulate the goal of non-racialism, a non-racial society, But then they'd
same
start,
as a post-racial society as we
say,
hear?
Or yeah. even a colorblind society sure, that right. people use all the time. So they'd say, that's our goal. But then they'd say, the way to that goal always lies through race. So you have to actually address the racial aspects of class problems and poverty problems and economic problems without losing the fact that there's also a class dimension there.
What's the quick response when people say, I want to live in a post-racial society, or aren't we moving toward, or aren't we already living and we have a black president or a partially black president? We're post-racial now, right?
Well, I think the quick response is this wealth gap, is to think about the wealth gap and the material facts and the incarceration gap. I mean, for black families, Latino families, the idea that their 19 to 35-year-old male population is so much in the system and so much in prison is a big material difference. And it's a big material difference that, as I said before, exists despite the fact that we know that drug use, which sends half of the people to prison, is distributed equally or maybe a little bit more toward white young people. But somehow they get care instead of imprisonment. Again, I don't know if that's a privilege. I think it's an advantage.
How much of the drug war has been a failure and connected to these problems in incarceration and in the gaps that we're talking about?
Oh, I think it's a tremendous problem. I just recently spoke in a big penitentiary in Illinois, and there were 120 people there. 10 maybe were white inmates. The rest were black and Latino inmates, and overwhelmingly they were there for victimless drug crimes.
I don't usually cite this network or this host, but on this subject, PBS's Tavis Smiley was a guest on Bill O'Reilly's show, and they talked about incarceration, and O'Reilly was making the point, and again, I think it is a window into how certain parts of the population think, and you know, O'Reilly's making the point that the drug war is not racist. He doesn't buy that it's generally victimless, that most of the time he thinks that's a bogus term, but you're saying, no, you've been in these penitentiaries, and that quote-unquote victimless drug crimes are very much a part of the system.
Yeah, and, you know, I think we should be honest. We've also all been in families that have had drug problems and where, with a little bit greater resources, our kids and our loved ones get sent into treatment and, you know, or get sent home by a policeman who catches people with drugs. I think it's very important for people to actually think about their own lives when they think of it. I'm talking here about white people, to think about their own lives, their own offenses, their own jaywalking. Do you know anybody who doesn't jaywalk? And yet, in Ferguson, one of the biggest problems is that people can go to jail for months, get shuttled from one jail to another because they have outstanding warrants for jaywalking. So I think we have to a little bit be honest, and I think that that's maybe one place where I'd part company with O'Reilly, is that it's not actually true that I think that white people can forget how outside of the law that we sometimes are also.
When it comes to what to do about the drug war, the extreme end of it, some just say legalization and treat it like a medical problem and stop criminalizing, start there. Too far? What do you think?
I think that's the way, the general way, and probably the way that most of the world addresses individual use of drugs, not drug trafficking, but individual use of drugs. I think that that's a start, and I think it is actually in place for the white middle class. That in some ways there is a decriminalization, and it's very likely that 10 years from now, the marijuana part of that will have actually happened.
I think
it
we're
seems like
in that
it's going to happen. Yeah.
I mean, it feels almost inevitable. It feels like marijuana is on the same track in terms of public opinion and policy that same-sex marriage was, maybe a decade behind.
Yeah, exactly. And 10 years ago, you would have thought, oh, people who think there's going to be same-sex marriage in Missouri? That's crazy. And now there is. And, you know, I think that marijuana is on that track.
Yeah. We're talking to David Roediger, the author of a number of books, including The Wages of Whiteness, Race and the Making of the American Working Class. And the newest book is Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation and Liberty for All, that takes a look at post-Civil War. And you wanted to dig into what part of history and why, David?
Well, I was interested in how we tell the story about emancipation. And I was teaching at University of Illinois at the time, so that the story always was about Lincoln and Lincoln freeing the slaves and various anniversaries of different Lincoln activities, and particularly the Emancipation Proclamation. The older story, and the story that 30 years ago was the accepted wisdom, is that slaves freed themselves, that the war was not about slavery in its early stages, and that slaves, by virtue of making their way to the Union Army and disrupting the Confederacy and presenting commanders and ultimately Lincoln with this choice about what to do with them, changed the war into an emancipatory war. This is actually very much a local story of Rochester, because the person who most successfully intervened in debates about the meaning of the war was Frederick Douglass. And Douglass, early in the war, called the war to preserve slavery. And he meant Lincoln's also saying he's okay with preserving slavery. He doesn't think the war is about emancipation. We have to prove to him that the war is about emancipation. So the first half of the book is to reassert this old story that slaves freed themselves and forced Lincoln into glorious Emancipation Proclamations. The second half, again with some Rochester connections, is to say, after that impossible thing happens, that slaves overnight are freed, mostly through their own efforts, what do people who got to witness that transformation do with the knowledge? And so it argues that all of a sudden, women's activists are able, and Susan B. Anthony is a principal figure here, all of a sudden those activists are able to aggressively contest for women's suffrage in a way that they never had been able to do before, in part because they've seen that the impossible can happen and can happen relatively overnight. And they have a long experience of relations with the abolitionist movement and with the freedom of slaves. And so you all of a sudden get this modern women's movement. Same thing with the labor movement. All of a sudden you get this debate by soldiers sitting around in army camps saying, what would be our emancipation? What would be freedom for us? And their solution is an 8-hour working day. And people are working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. If they're lucky, they have a 10-hour day. But at least half the day is the boss's time. Even if you work a 10-hour day, you're working from 6 in the morning till 6 at night with lunch and dinner in it. So this demand is all of a sudden saying, no, we should control 2/3 of the day ourselves. Didn't exist anywhere in the world. It's a particularly United States demand. And it grows, the book argues, out of these soldiers having seen what slaves did to emancipate themselves and seeing that actually things can change.
Not to get hung up on Lincoln, but you know, last week, given 150 years since his assassination, there was a lot of conversation. I talked to the author of a book on Lincoln's sort of political philosophy, and he raised the point that too often in the United States, students are taught kind of an either or. Was the war about preserving the Union or about freeing the slaves? Preserving the Union was number one. That's what Lincoln wanted to do. 1A might have been emancipation, but it was not required. Number one was required. Right. But it wasn't in Lincoln's heart that Lincoln would seem to be the kind of person who thought, I might not be Thaddeus Stevens, we might not be doing this overnight, but inevitably this Union will not allow slavery to exist in perpetuity, that it will be gone, that we have to preserve the Union first, and that's what the war must be about. And if I can free all the slaves or some of them or none of them, we've got to preserve the Union. But did he also think slavery is not long for this Union anyway?
I think it depends when we're talking about. The actual way that slaves were emancipated would have seemed impossible to someone like Lincoln in 1860. If you think about emancipation occurring without any planning, without any compensation. And way into the war, Lincoln was still trying to figure out how to compensate because slaves were property. Mm-hmm. And so for him and other mainstream leaders, there had to be this enormous payment, $3 billion of payment for slaves. So unplanned, uncompensated, overnight, and then to boot with guns. So pretty soon after emancipation, freed people were given guns and admitted into the army. Well, if you would have said that should happen in 1860, that was crazy. That was John Brown, to pick another New Yorker. That was what John Brown said in 1859, was that this unplanned, uncompensated, armed emancipation ought to take place. By 1862, late in 1862, this is Lincoln's policy. But Lincoln loved that John Brown got executed. Lincoln gloried in John Brown's execution. In 1859 and 1860, that was an impossible demand, immediate, unplanned emancipation. And Lincoln shared in the view that that was impossible and shared in the view that Brown was a madman because of that. So you end up having to explain, why is it that Lincoln could take this glorious stand by 1862? And to say that is not to deny that it's glorious and that Lincoln had a tremendous role in history, but it is to say that the conditions for him to be able to do that were created by the movement of slaves.
The book is called Seizing Freedom, Slave Emancipation, and Liberty for All. Just got a few minutes left here with David Roediger, and tell us what you've been talking to students about. We've kind of touched on that, but what have you been talking to students about?
I visited very interesting classes at Hobart and William Smith, one of which was on educational reform, and actually talked about charter schools and teachers' unions, and I think teachers Teach for America is still very much on the mind of some of the young people, was on the mind of some of the young people in that class. And then I visited another class on racisms, which talked about anti-black racism in the United States in connection with anti-Semitism and other forms of social prejudice. So I was very, very impressed with the visit and enjoyed the classes as much as given the lecture.
Sometimes on this program, when we mine subjects like this, we try to think about what we could do to change. And we have a diverse listening audience. We've got all backgrounds socioeconomically. But for white listeners who are relatively well-to-do, who do care deeply about this, what do we do on either a day-to-day basis or at least in our own lives to try to affect change?
Well, one reason that I was glad that Seizing Freedom came out when it did amidst all of the Ferguson and Eric Garner protests is that it really does suggest that when one group of people begins to act on their own behalf, that we can see spectacular things happen in terms of alliances, solidarities that develop. So I think that we should be open to the idea that we're actually living through a period of significant activity in the Black Freedom Movement again, and that the Ferguson protests have opened something that is going to be ongoing, tragically, in part because there are so many killings of suspects that in one city after another, there will be this issue raised again and again. So we're in the presence of a kind of freedom movement activity that we haven't been in the presence of, arguably, for a considerable amount of time. And immediately in Ferguson, when people started to camp out around the place where Mike Brown was killed, trans people came and joined that encampment. Black lesbian leadership emerged in the Black Lives Matter movement in St. Louis. So again, we see not only activity on the behalf of the freedom of one group of people, but that proves a little bit contagious in a healthy sort of way, and we should be aware that we're going to see these kinds of things, and that we've begun, really, I think, since Arab Spring, to see how movements kind of spread and inspire each other, and we should be ready to be inspired.
When it comes, last point then, when it comes to these movements, Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times took a little bit of heat when he suggested a couple of months ago, he was comparing Mike Brown Eric Garner, Tamir Rice in Cleveland, and he was looking at the evidence, the new video of the Tamir Rice shooting, a 12-year-old shot outside, instantly by a police officer who probably should never have been on the force and was deemed unqualified by a different department. And Eric Garner, we obviously have the video of that. And then we were getting the Justice Department report that was at least indicating some ambiguity about what happened with Michael Brown and the thought that maybe Michael Brown did reach in and try to grab Darren Wilson's gun. And Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times wrote, maybe protesters sort of hitched up to the wrong case. It shouldn't have been Michael Brown. Maybe Eric Garner, maybe Tamir Rice would have been more powerful because they're more unequivocal, whereas some people who are pushing back look at the Michael Brown case and say, he was never hands up, don't shoot, you're manipulating, whereas Nicholas Kristof says, we may not know that, but we can look at Eric Garner, we can look at Tamir Rice, and we can know. But is that missing the point, or do you think Nick Kristof has a point?
I think that it is a debate that we've been having about incarceration for a long time. That so you have 2 million people in prison, most incarcerating nation in the world, overwhelmingly racially skewed prison population. One impulse is to say, oh, we should try to separate the innocent from the guilty and address the problem in that way. Another is to say, we've created this problem, which is tremendous and complicated, and we need to draw back from over-incarceration in general. So I think a lot of people didn't think that Mike Brown, I know a lot of people didn't think in the movement in St. Louis that Mike Brown was innocent in the and certainly not perfect, but that he was a young person who was caught up in doing a lot of different things at once and was certainly caught up in these extraordinarily perilous and frustrating relationships with the police that have to do with warrants and municipal courts. So I think the sympathy was not about this is an innocent person. The sympathy was about this is a person who's like a lot of our kids.
David Roediger, a pleasure to have you. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
David Roediger is a historian, author, and professor himself, and he was his visit, I should say, to Rochester and Hobart and William Smith Colleges was facilitated by one of their professors. Joel Helfrich is a professor of environmental studies at HWS. He's also a local historian. He's on the line with us just for a few more minutes to close the hour. Joel, thank you for taking the time.
Hi, Evan.
Well, tell me about your impressions of David Roediger, especially his interaction with your students.
Listening to the talk just now, it's kind of hard to figure out where to start, but a number of the students were excited to have him on campus. I think the students and Dave got a lot out of being on campus during the several days that he was in town, and they realized, that he gets it, not only through his research and writings, but also through his lived experiences. You know, he talked about the sundown towns, one of which he lived in Illinois. Also through his anti-racism organizing, his travels and writings in the United States and Africa and elsewhere. You know, I think that the students had a great opportunity to not only read his work, but also discuss his writings with him.
You are not only a historian, but you teach environmental studies. But what attracted you to David Roediger specifically? As a professor of environmental studies, why bring in someone like David Roediger to Hobart?
Well, let me back up just a second.
Yeah.
So I'm a historian by training, and my advisor in graduate school was Dave Roediger. So when I graduated from the University of Rochester, I was trying to figure out where to go to school, and one of the places that I settled on was the University of Minnesota, and it wasn't because of Minnesota. It was because of the fact that Dave was teaching there at the time. And so I pursued a master's degree elsewhere for a year and then headed off to Minneapolis to study with Dave. And so he's been an advisor to me. He's also been an amazing mentor and also a person that I consider a good friend. He's a really good guy, and I actually couldn't have had a better person to work with. So when I had this opportunity through some funding at Hobart and William Smith to bring Dave to campus, I just kind of jumped at it. And I thought it was going to be good for the students, and then also, to be honest, a little bit of a selfish reason as an opportunity for me to thank him for, all of his advice, kindness, mentoring, and the example that he provides.
And Joel, I got about a minute left here. Some people get cynical about college students, this generation, millennials. We've seen studies indicating some things that are not very flattering to the generation. But I think that it's dangerous to be overly cynical. Do you see them as engaged, interested in this subject, mixing it up with David Roediger, listening, absorbing these lessons?
Oh, I definitely. I mean, we have so many examples just within the past few months that show how engaged students are in our society. Whether we're talking about organizing around global warming and the rally that was held in New York City last year, or in Washington, D.C. a year or so before that, or we're talking about events on campus where students protested, regarding the events in Ferguson or in New York City and elsewhere. The reality is that students are engaged on campus. I couldn't be more proud of the students that I have and that whom I've worked with. They're really the best students anywhere at Hobart and Weems Smith in particular, but I think my general sense is that places like the University of Kansas, where Dave teaches, and elsewhere, these students are engaged.
Well, certainly I know they appreciate the fact that you, as their professor, brought Dave Roediger here to Rochester at Hobart and Weems Smith, and thank you for making him available to Connections and for us to have this conversation with him and with you today. We look forward to more conversations in the future.
Thanks, Evan.
Joel Helfrich, a professor of environmental studies at Hobart and Weems Smith Colleges, a local historian as well. Our thanks to Joel and to David Roediger for his time this hour. Thanks to you for listening. Val LeBanc of the Wonderful Job Engineering. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.